is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, well, I'm thrilled today. I have two fascinating books, completely different from each other, but you know, this is the fun of doing Joy on Paper. I get to do the books that I love. And so I want to start today. You know, I grew up, as all of my listeners know, I grew up in northern Michigan. And it's a beautiful countryside there, rolling hills, wonderful rolling hills. And we go, you know, we can drive for miles sometimes without ever seeing anybody. And it's just a lovely place to live. And when I was a little girl, now, my dad was a World War II vet. He was a serious guy, hardworking guy. But there was one thing about him that was really very, very special. He was silly about rainbows. We would be driving down the road, and, you know, with these rolling hills, you get these little bumps in the road. And normally, you just drive over them, and you don't notice them. But when he saw a rainbow, whether it was to the left or to the right, he would play catch the rainbow. He would, if the rainbow was to the left, he would find the first left turn and he would make that turn. And then he would keep going. And whenever we got to an area where there was a little bump, he would speed up and give us a little belly bump. And I mean, it was absolutely a wonderful, silly, delightful game he played with us. And of course, all of the kids, we would just all be giggling our heads off. And it didn't matter if, for example, we were on our way to somebody's house and we were supposed to be there at 5 o'clock. He would chase that rainbow until it disappeared. And it was so much fun. It was one of the most wonderful things of my childhood, chasing that rainbow, because it was a time when he was just so silly. And my mom might say, oh, we're going to be late. But he didn't care. We were going to chase that rainbow, and he was going to give us a thrill ride of belly bumps. So when I got this book that I'm going to be talking about today, it really moved my heart and reminded me of those wonderful days and of about love. And so I'm really honored today to have on the program, you know, somebody who's written a book that really is in many ways heartbreaking, but it's also inspirational. And it is called The End of the Rainbow, One Man's Unexpected Journey of Love and Loss Through Leukemia. James Forker, thank you so much for joining me on Joy on Paper today.
Thanks, Patsy. Thanks for having me.
Well, as you can see immediately, I mean, right from the cover of your book, rainbows mean something to me in many ways. And I was really thrilled that I had this opportunity to have you on the program to talk about this book. Because, you know, I start the program always that this is a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And sometimes people, they have stories and they don't think, you know, that they have a book in them, that they can write the story. But it is important to share these stories. And you have done a beautiful job with this book. So why don't you tell us about it? And then, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about the writing process, and because you've done a really great job.
No, I appreciate the kind words. I never thought that I'd be a writer. It's just life gave me a story, and the story really focuses on meeting my wife and our relationship and some of the ups and downs and challenges that dating and all that, you know, brings to a relationship, and what made us stronger that led us to being married. And it also involves the fact that when I first met her, she was married and she had a child. But I knew the minute that I met her that I was going to marry her. And I just knew. And so the beginning of the book is about that time in our lives. And then it picks up from the day she was diagnosed with leukemia, and this was after 13 years of marriage and us having two additional children. And the rest of the story follows our journey from the day she got diagnosed throughout her course of treatment and treatment failures and some minor successes, and culminating with the image of the rainbow that appeared throughout the time after she passed. And I began writing the story a couple months after she passed away in an effort to not forget and have something to give my children. So this was truly a labor of love over the course of 2 years. And honestly, I started writing because I was looking for something that would help me get through this period. Well, you never get through it, but to get through the period. And I didn't find anything that I could relate to from the perspective of a 44-year-old widow of three children. So that was the impetus for me to write, and just hoping that if this could help people in similar situations remember their love and everything that was brought to them, and coping with experience and, you know, terminal illness. That was why I wrote.
Well, you've done a wonderful job. You tell the story, and it's so gentle in many ways. It's very, you know, it's always so hard to deal with a subject like this. It's always so hard to have to deal with tragedy. But what I really enjoyed about the book was that as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, there are people who will be reading this, and it will help them. One, I think people will say, whoa, I've got this life that, you know, James had, this life that you think everything is okay, everything's moving forward, and then, boom, something happens. So appreciate what you have and make the most of every minute, really, really, because it can change in one telephone call.
Yeah, and that's very true. I received a telephone call while I was on an airplane going to New York City, and my wife had been not feeling great, but you chalk it up to all sorts of other ailments, being a, you know, 43-year-old working mom of three. And I remember that phone call like it was yesterday, and the world stopped. And I'm sure that happens to many, many people. And then it's, you know, what happens after that phone call, or what happens after that information that's given to you, and how do you work through it with support of friends and family, and also just, you know, looking inside of yourself and figuring out what the next plan is, and how to get through the day, get through the week, and get, you know, and the challenge I had was trying to support my kids and then, you know, financially support our family and also support my wife while she was undergoing all the treatment for leukemia.
Now, you know, people hear about leukemia, and unless they've had somebody you know, in their family, many people don't understand what it is. When I was young, I worked in a lab, so I actually dealt quite a bit with people who had leukemia. I was doing the tests and things, and I was around it, so I know a great deal about it. But and in those days, of course, leukemia was an absolute death sentence. Nowadays, they have made enormous strides. It didn't work with your wife, but tell us a little bit about what you discovered about leukemia and how you took it when you first learned about it.
You know, it's funny. I've been in the medical field for years in various capacities, but when I learned of her diagnosis, the first thing I did, which many people do, is go to their phones and learn about it. And I was scared to learn more because I didn't know. And leukemia is basically cancer. In her case, she had ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is cancer of the white blood cells that normally fight infections. And is as in cancer, the cells do not grow and develop properly, filling up the bone marrow inside bones where blood is normally made. So essentially, the cancer spreads throughout the blood. And you're right, there's been many advances. So there's no tumors or, it's different than other types of cancers because it spreads throughout your body through the bloodstream. And they have made remarkable advances in leukemia over the years. It's more common in children, and the advances that they made for children have been amazing. And for older people, my wife was a bit of an anomaly, and she had a white blood cell count when she was diagnosed that Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston had rarely ever seen. And they were amazed that she was able to do what she was doing up until the time that she got sick. So I started looking online and Googling everything that I could, because that's what I do right away, even before we learned the extent of her illness. So it was, she went through chemo, she went through radiation, and eventually she had a stem cell transplant donated. The cells were donated by her sister, which unfortunately she relapsed quickly after that. So I saw it all from start to finish as far as treatment that worked and treatment that didn't and made her really ill. And, then she took it upon herself to change her diet and lifestyle to help with her improvement, which did, I believe, helped her live a bit longer than she should have.
Well, it's so difficult. It's so difficult to deal with this, of course, leukemia, because as I said, I worked in a lab. I looked at tens of thousands of blood slides of blood, cultures, and it's just heartbreaking from that point of view. But there was so much about her. Tell us about her, because she was a really wonderful woman. There was so much that I wanted to know her, and I'm so glad that you did write this book so that you do keep her alive and for your children. And I think her also, some of the things that she thought and that she suffered will help people understand really how to appreciate life.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm glad that came through in the story, because I really wanted to share more about who she was as a person, and I feel like there's journal entries from her when we first started dating that really shares her voice. But no, I mean, I could fill up a 5-hour podcast as far as how she inspired me to live my life. And prior, I never had met somebody that just had so much, zest and energy around the things that she loved, and it was infectious. Jen was a quiet person, and she was introspective, but when she enjoyed things, she wanted to share it with the world, like hiking and yoga and traveling. And I have taken that upon myself with my kids since she passed to continue her love of these things, especially with hiking and camping and traveling. And, I make sure that my kids appreciate that, because she taught me how to value those things, outside and being outside and just enjoying the company of others. And it has completely changed my perspective on life. And you've already mentioned, life is too short, and she never had time for pettiness and arguments and things that just, fractured relationships. She was not that person. And I learned so much from her. I think every day, how did this happen to her? But I'm trying to take this experience and hopefully give other people a perspective on how to live lives, because life is, it's too short. We don't have much time here.
Exactly. And I do like that it is from a male perspective, because too often men will hold it in and they won't share. So many women, they lose their husbands and they'll write about it. I mean, it's almost instinctive. They start writing. And there will be dozens and dozens of novels or, you know, memoirs about losing a husband, but not as many men do it. And I think it's important because it shows, well, first of all, you know what's wonderful about the book? It's nice to know a man can love a woman so deeply. Because sometimes women, you know, you start thinking, oh, well, men don't really have all these deep feelings, you know. But it's not true. Men love, when they love so deeply. It's so much a part of their soul. And as you said, you fell in love with her immediately and you knew. And that connection and knowing that men can have this deep, this greatness in them, I think is also really inspirational for women to read this book. Read this book and you'll say, I think you'll have more appreciation for your own husband. You'll look at him. You know, men are so busy. They're working so much of their time. They're taking care of their families. They're always, you know, got things to do. And sometimes they might not, a woman might look at them and say, well, they're not deep. They're not, you know, thinking about being in love. But actually, it's there. And you brought that out.
No, thank you. And you don't, I mean, you don't know what you have until it's gone. I know it sounds cliche, but, you know, looking back, I know that I took things for granted and, you know, we just went about our business. But, no, the love was there, and I wish I had, you know, many more opportunities to tell her. I mean, obviously I still talk to her, but, you know, to tell her these things. And, no, I appreciate the fact that came through. And to your point, I did not find anything from a male perspective, and it was usually from a women's perspective, or if I did find a male, it was somebody who was married for 50 years, and it was just different, and it didn't resonate with me. So, yeah, I think it's as much as a love story as it is, you know, a story about, loss, really.
Loss and strength of from both sides, from you and from her. And this wonderful, also the story of the friends and the final celebration of her life. I thought that was very moving.
Yeah, thank you. It was Jen's wish to have a celebration, and she wanted people to be smiling and having a party. Versus, I mean, this is true to her character, right? And enjoying time together versus being sad. And parts of it was definitely sad. But, you know, over 600 people showed up for the celebration, and it was really a testament to her and her life and just, you know, all the people that she touched. And there were plenty more throughout the country that weren't able to make it. But, yeah, it's still moving when I think about it. But it was exactly what she would want.
Well, it's a beautiful tribute. The entire book has been very well written, and a book that I really want to recommend to everyone. It's, you know, you think it's going to be just sad, but it's not, because as I said, it is a celebration of life. And Jen was really a very, very special woman, and to have 600 people show up for your, you know, to celebrate your life is pretty impressive. And I want people to read this book. It's called The End of the Rainbow, One Man's Unexpected Journey of Love and Loss Through Leukemia. And you've done, you know, James, you've done a wonderful thing for your family to write this book. You seem to be a natural writer. Perhaps there'll be another book in you. This one, maybe the fun of having three kids to raise, And because I'm sure you have lots of.
There's plenty of stories.
Plenty of stories there. So perhaps there's another book for them and for you.
Perhaps.
Because James Forker, I think you're really impressive. Do you have a website or where do people? The book is available wherever books are sold, of course, online. Anywhere else?
The website is at endoftherainbowbook.com.
Endoftherainbowbook.com. Well, everybody, get this book. Really, it's funny, you know, a book that is about something so sad can be so uplifting. And I want to thank you again, James, for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Take care.
Bye. Wow. You know, this is what I'm saying. There's a book in everybody. And you don't know when it's going to come out. But he's a natural writer. Really fine writing. A very uplifting story. Okay, we're going to play a poem. Oh, no, I don't have a poem. You know, one of these days I'm going to get myself organized here. This has been a really, really busy time. What I'm going to do, I'm going to go to commercials. And then when I come back, if my caller doesn't get on the phone, I'm going to play a poem by Jim Lamb because I want to hear it. But we'll be back in a few minutes after the commercials.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm just waiting for my next guest to call in. But while I'm waiting, I want to play Jim Lamb's poem for you here.
Nothing More, Nothing Less by J.S. Lamb. We all know about everything, not more and nothing less. We know about what our neighbor's done and why his home's a mess. We learned it from the internet, TV, and radio. We know about the latest fads, like honey Cheerios. Soon all the news will be sent out directly to our brains. We'll hear about new wars and films, or if it's going to rain. What matters if the world will end by fiercely feisty flames? There'll be no way to make it stop or start it all again. I'd like to hide in goldfish bowls or quiet, sheltered caves just to get a little rest before I dig my grave.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, well, that poem is from Jim Lamb, and he's going to be giving us a little lesson next week in writing, and I'm looking forward to having that segment on next week. But now I want to talk about something. You know, when I started high school, the first class I signed up for was Latin because I wanted to be an archaeologist. So I started, actually, I didn't want to take any other classes because I actually knew everything by that point. But I'll go into that another time. But Latin, I was starting off on the ground floor, equal with everybody. And so first year Latin, wow, I was thrilled. We had 28 kids in the class, and I was elected the president of SPQR Society because, well, because I'm a natural leader, because I'm bossy, I don't know why. Anyway, and also I was able to make really great togas. Anyway, I loved first year Latin. Second year Latin, oh, what a kick I got out of it. I was getting better and better, and the class had gone down to about 20 people. Third year Latin, well, it was started to dwindle, and we were down to about 12. By fourth year Latin, and they had never had a fourth year Latin at that school before because nobody else studied that years, but the Latin teacher was like thrilled, like, my gosh, what am I doing right? There were five of us, three girls, two boys. And we were studying Latin, and it was really great. But we'd already done Caesar's Gallic Wars. And we were, I must say, the five of us were starting a little bit, doing a little bit of Ovid too much. And Ars Amoratia was perhaps not what the teacher wanted us to read. So she gave us John Locke's an essay in Latin to translate. Now, most of you don't know John Locke just off the top of your head, but he was an important writer, and he wrote a wonderful book called An Essay Concerning Human Understanding. And I love John Locke, and the book is great, and I can say that I've actually translated John Locke from Latin to English. But I never expected, and I'm sure John Locke did not expect, that when this book was published in 1695, that he would be the subject of the first paragraph of an absolutely terrific and marvelous and fantastic book written by a genius writer by the name of Jenny Elder Moak. And the name of the book is called Curse of the Spectre Queen. I am so happy to welcome Jenny to the program today. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, wow, oh, wow. And I pronounce it right. It's Moak, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Got it. Spot on.
Okay, spot on. And Jenny, I know, you know, as I said, in the first paragraph, you actually drop, well, your main character, Sam, who I really love, drops poor John Locke on the floor.
No.
Oh my gosh, my heart stopped. I'm going to tell you this. You know, I have a real close connection with John Locke. Not many people can say they've actually translated his Latin into English. So I've had this real connection to him for all these years, and I was a little upset that you dropped him. But
oh, I know.
But I think he would appreciate it in the end because I think he would get a kick out of this book because he actually did have a sense of humor, although he wrote some really serious stuff.
Well, you're certainly ahead of the game. Then you're farther ahead than I am because I have not translated John Locke from Latin.
Well, you know, what is wonderful about this book? Well, what is not wonderful? I mean, what is wonderful? Everything is wonderful about this book. Because as I said, I took Latin because I wanted to be an archaeologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I took Latin because I was very bookish. We didn't have that word nerd in those days. But by that point, when I started high school, I had already read, you know, at least 5,000 books, 6,000 books. And to tell you the truth, I already knew all the subjects in all the other classes. The only classes that I didn't know were the ones that were hands-on, like chemistry and biology and, you know, where I get to cut open a frog or make smoke bombs, and Latin, because I started off equal to everybody. You know, the English classes were a joke. History classes were a joke. I was already reading. I mean, I was reading John Locke in English. So, you know, those other classes, I was really bored in school.
But you were a real fan. You guys would have gotten along very well.
Oh, yeah. So I really love Sam. Sam is a wonderful character. And, of course, it's set in a bookstore. I mean, what, you know, everything about this book, any book about set in a the bookstore, I'm like, this is book was made for me. Why didn't I write it? I don't know, because I could just hit myself on the head, but not with a book. I do not use books to hit myself on the head. A frying pan might do it, because I should have been as clever as you, because I actually like your name very much. Jenny Eldermoak. Ah, it's cool. It's a cool name.
It's got some gravitas.
Yeah, it does. It does.
It's the elder that really.
Yeah, elder. That's it. You're impressive. And then you set this book in the 1920s, which is also now my favorite period, because I don't like the 2020s, I'm telling you right now.
Oh, God.
Oh, gosh.
It is real funny. I was just talking about this with someone yesterday. It is funny to almost be back in the same place 100 years later.
I know. But I think the 1920s, everybody dressed better. You know.
Oh, man, they did.
Oh, yeah.
So stylish.
Oh, stylish. And there's so much to work with. You have so much to work with that era.
I definitely did. You know, it was a really great, the Roaring Twenties was a great time for women, because you sort of had that first wave of women saying, you know what, we deserve a place in this world too, not just as someone's daughter or spouse or, you know, mother, but we deserve our own place in the world. And so you had this incredible flapper culture, but then you also had really the advent of what we know of as modern archaeology, because I don't think most people realize that archaeology up until that point was really done by like private people, amateur archaeologists, not always done with the scientific method in mind. But then in 1923, Howard Carter discovered the tomb of King Tutankhamun, which was sort of that was the archaeological find of the century. But it really opened up the field, and people got really obsessed with Egyptology. People started investing in archaeology as a real field and not just something that rich British men could do in their time off. So it was a great place to put a curious, driven, really clever young woman who's in the middle of stuff changing, and she kind of gets to change along with it. So it was a really great place for me to put a character.
It is ideal. And as I said, when I took Latin, the reason I did, because I wanted to be an archaeologist. Now, I didn't become an archaeologist, but I have been on many archaeological digs. I lived in the Middle East for many years. I was involved with digs in Israel and in what's called Takht-e Jamshid, which is Persepolis in Iran. So I've been, you know, at many archaeological sites. And so everything about Sam, I really like. And what I want to really mention right off the bat is that Sam is not, you've sort of, you know, for YA fiction, there's been this trope playing of really, how can I say, not angry young women, well, maybe angry young women, a little bit too angry. Sam is driven in many ways, but she's there's a gentleness about her too that I really appreciate.
Yeah, I like to call her bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. That's kind of her personality to me, and I think that there is a lot of the way that I would describe a lot of heroines now is when you come into a lot of stories, they're already kind of complete. You know, they're already set in who they are. And Sam is very much not set in who she is. She doesn't know, you know, when you come into the book and you first meet her, she's kind of holed herself away from the world. You know, her father died in the Great War, and when she was quite young, and that really changed the course of her life. You know, she had these dreams and aspirations of being an archaeologist, But when her father didn't come home from the war, she set them aside because she was afraid of the world and she was grieving and she didn't know how to deal with that grief. And so her way of dealing with it was she sort of scuttled herself away in this antique bookshop in rural Illinois. And she told herself that she's happy, that she'll, if that's the only life she ever has, she'll be happy with it. But of course, we know as the reader, that's never true. But it always takes an outside impetus to get your hero on their journey. So she's working in this bookshop, and then she receives a mysterious diary one day that has a coded letter in it. But she soon learns that she's not the only one interested in that diary.
Okay, we're not getting, we're not telling anybody. We're not giving anything away. Because the book opens, I love, one of my favorite names is George or Georgie. And so I love her mailman. Because I got such a kick out of him. Because since I started this program, I've had two mailmen. The first mailman was he was so delightful because he listened. When he was driving around in his little van thing, he would listen nonstop to Audible books and mostly David Baldacci books. He could quiz me on David Baldacci books. He'd say, well, what happened in book number 5? And I mean, you know, I read, you know, these books. I know all these books, but not, you know, that I can pinpoint things. And he never minded that books would arrive at my, you know, half the books would, you know, arrive at my home. And you know, so he didn't mind. The more books that came, the happier he was. And then he retired. And one of the reasons when he retired, he said, well, you know, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back and read all the Baldacci books. Because before that, he'd only listened to them.
Oh.
My new mailman came a little before the pandemic year. And so when the pandemic came and I wasn't coming into the studio, I had all the books sent to my home. The new mailman does not appreciate books. I mean, really does not appreciate books. And so when you have, right in the beginning, you have Georgie, the mailman, saying, books, books, books. I thought, oh my goodness. I know somebody just like you, Georgie.
Spot on.
Exactly. So this is, I thought that was so cool. Everything about this book, as I said, just one thing after another. I got into it. I loved it. And let's talk. We're not going to tell the story because I don't want anyone to know, because I'll tell you one thing. It's action packed. You're, first of all, within a page, you know that someday you're going to see this on film. I don't know. Do you have a film deal? Yes. Because last week I had somebody on who had just gotten a film deal and it was a secret. And she was shocked when I said, do you have a film deal? And she thought like somebody had whispered it in my ear and I knew something. Do you have a film deal yet?
Well, I am excited to say that the TV rights for Curse of the Spectre Queen have already been optioned.
Okay, so I knew it.
Share any details?
No, you can't give details. I knew it. I knew it. The minute you dropped that, John Locke, because I thought if they're going to put that in the scene, and I'm going to be watching that scene, and I'm going to be screaming, no, don't do that to John, don't do that. I know. I'm telling you from the first paragraph, I saw it. I knew it, and this is so wonderful. You know, I used to write scripts in Hollywood. And so when I get a book and I see it as a movie, and when I see it as a movie from paragraph one, I mean, I was writing that scene and I was trying to say, okay, I know as a screenwriter, it'll kill me. It'll kill me to write, drop that book.
Oh, well, then there's some scenes later on that get even more to the heart of that love of...
Oh, I know. I don't want to go into it. So instead, let's talk about the characters, the three main characters in the story. Tell us just a little bit about each. Well, we know now that Sam, you know, is a reader, nerdy thing, but tell us about her two friends, Bennett and...
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, Sam is... She's the daughter of a farmer who was killed during the Great War. Her mother is the laundress for the town, takes in all of the town's laundry and does it. And so she comes from humble beginnings, but she has grand aspirations that she sort of set aside at the beginning of the story. But then the other two characters who come along on her journey, I call them Sam and Co., are Joanna Steeling, who is her childhood best friend. And she is, Joanna is the daughter of basically the town's benefactor. So her father is Mr. Steeling, who runs the textile mill in the town, and he's a big textile magnate. And he's also Sam's employer, so he owns that. He's one of those rich British men, except he's American, who likes to dabble in archaeology in his spare time. And so that's how Sam and Joanna have kind of come to know each other. They did these treasure hunts that Joanna's father would put on for them when they were growing up, and he'd put codes in them, and he'd take real treasures that he had found on digs, and that sort of sparked Sam's love of archaeology from the beginning. But Joanna's a little bit different. She's a little bit of a loose cannon. She's clever, but she doesn't always know it, because Sam and her brother Bennett, who also goes along with them, are really, they're like the brains of the operation. Bennett has never met a fact that he can't commit to memory. So he's like their knowledge bank. Anytime they need to know something about medieval Dublin, when they go there, if they need to know something about Celtic mythology, which is the mythology that the story is based around, is Irish Celtic mythology, he's the one who always knows that one stray little detail that you need to solve the clue. He's the one who knows that. But Joanna is the one who can get them out of the stickiest of situations. So they're really a good like triangle of support. So I'd say that, you know, Joe is the sticky fingers, Bennett is the brain, and then Sam is the heart. So
okay,
I don't think they could solve their mysteries without each other.
A wonderful trio. And now, what about Bennett? Is this a nod at Jane Austen?
Actually, Bennett's a funny character to me, because Bennett is very old school. He's very protective. Some would call him overprotective. But I think when your sister and her best friend, who also is, you know, has a childhood crush on you, when they are in mortal danger, there's no concept of being overprotective. It's like, well, you know, sure, he's being a little overbearing, but also there are evil people out trying to kill you. So, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable. But honestly, Bennett's kind of like, he's the me of the trio. I'm the one who's always like, guys, we should definitely call the proper authorities. This is not something for us scrappy kids to handle. So I think he's much more for me. He's like my stand-in of who I would be in that adventure situation.
Now, did you pick that name as a nod to Jane Austen? A little bit of the Bennett family there?
You know what? I didn't, but now it's quite possible it was subconscious.
Subconscious, because I was thinking, was she looking a little bit for a Darcy, you know, Mr. Darcy in Bennett?
He does probably share a lot of those.
That's what I thought. So I thought maybe it was subconscious. Somewhere deep within you, Jane Austen was speaking to you and whispering in your ear. How about that?
Quite possible.
Because it's an unusual name for a character. And I thought, perhaps that's true.
You solved something that I didn't know about myself.
Well, see, your mind, my mind and your mind, maybe we'll meld, because I love your mind.
I think so.
I love your mind. I love the way you think. And
oh, thank you.
I don't know why you picked John Locke, but why would you pick John Locke? Because what are the chances? I mean, what are the chances that anybody who interviews you, and now because you're going to be, you know, world famous with a television series, how many interviewers do you think will come on and say, oh, by the way, I translated John Locke from Latin because my teacher did not want us to read so deeply into Ovid, because he wrote a lot of really sexy stuff. No, so she tried to keep us away. She wanted us to be educated. She wanted us to be... So she stuck us with that translation when we really would have preferred Ovid. But how many interviews do you think are going to be able to say that to you?
I can't imagine
any of
more
them.
Than this one. This one was already too serendipitous.
That's what I'm saying. It's so perfect. It's like somehow we're connected on this intergalactic, inter whatever planetary, inter where that I got a little bit in your mind, you got a little bit in my mind. Because why would you put, there's a million books you could have put on that first paragraph, but you picked him, which would immediately grab my interest, which would immediately make me want to read this book.
See, that's why it was in there.
It was in there.
So that you would find it.
Exactly.
You would get connected.
I would get connected to you. I think it's wonderful. I am so happy for you that you, I knew, of course, I didn't have to guess or anything. I knew it was going to happen for you because the characters are just too great, the wonderful trio. And I just wanted to ask, okay, we'll do your website thingy, but I noticed that you dedicated it to somebody in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And this is what I want to tell people. You can write wherever you want to write. You don't have to have, like, build a special house on, you know, high up on the mountain with panoramic views of something to write a book. You can write a book in a busy coffee shop, right?
Oh, I actually, that's probably, coffee shops are probably my favorite place to write.
Okay.
I highly recommend them. I miss them. I'm ready to go back to them.
When you're ready to write, yeah, exactly, go back to them. It's so long. But when you're ready to write, you can, if you're determined, you can write wherever you are, in a coffee shop, in a airport terminal, if anybody's flying anymore, you can write. It's just, you need to just knuckle under and do it and have fun. And you obviously had fun writing this book because it is a hoot. I think it is a hoot. And so, where do you want people to go to find out more about you and about what's going to happen, all the exciting things in your life?
Yes, absolutely. So my website is JennyElderMoke.com. And anybody who visits there can find links to buy my books. They can find information on them. Curse of the Spectre Queen is actually the first book in the Samantha Knox series. So the next one comes out in June of next year. I can't reveal the title yet, but that's coming soon. I promise it's just as epic as Curse of the Spectre Queen. And they can find links for my social media platforms, my bio, anything they could want to know about me is on my website.
Okay. And Jenny Elder Moke, you are going to be back here next June. And I'm really excited about it. I think you've done a terrific job with this book. And the book is Curse of the Spectre Queen. And it is available wherever books are sold. And get it and have some fun. Again, thank you so much, Jenny, for being on Joy on Paper today. It has been a real joy to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I will be happy to come back next year.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. Oh, I should have. Oh. You know, isn't it wonderful? I mean, isn't that strange that of all the books in the world that she'd put in that first paragraph, she would put a book that I... Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. Anyway, that's the wonderful thing about doing this program. I have so much fun. I have so much fun. And I all these connections that connect me to all of these different writers. You never know what's going to happen in life. But I did like, and I wanted her to say that about the writing in the coffee shop, because too often people will come to me and they say, oh, you know, I've got kids. I've got a husband. I've got this happening. You can write wherever you want. Douglas Brunt wrote Ghosts of Manhattan, a really wonderful book. He wrote it by hand on a yellow legal pad in the days when he was traveling like every other day doing consulting work around the country. And he didn't care that he was in a busy, at that time, the airports were very, very busy. He would just have that legal pad. He didn't need to have a computer with him. He didn't need anything else. All he needed was a good pen and a legal pad, and he wrote. And he didn't let himself get distracted by the noise around him. And here, look at this. She wrote this, what's going to be a best-selling book, and I'm sure a very popular series. And Jenny Elder Moke is, you know, she did it in a coffee shop. So this is what can happen. It's up to you. You have to be determined, and that's the most important thing. Wow. I want to say a special hello before I say goodbye to everybody. I want to say a special hello to Philip Vega, who is going to be at the Gasparilla Film Festival. As everyone knows, Phil has been on the program many times because I think that his books are also really great, and particularly his first book, Last Exit to Montauk, is a great book for a film. And this weekend, he's going to be at the Gasparilla Film Festival, along with Don Reese from Hollywood Connections. They're going to be over there, and they're going to be meeting and greeting, hopefully, producers and directors, because Philip's book is a multicultural love story. It's set a summer love story between a Hispanic boy and a blonde, blue-eyed girl, controversial in the 1980s, and not today, but it was set back then. Great music. It'll make a fun movie, and I'm hoping that he's going to make some connections this weekend at Gasparilla. But what I'm telling you, you just have to keep trying, and as an indie author, he has to promote himself, and so that's what he's learned to do now. He is just getting out there and promoting his book and trying to meet as many people as he can, because there are film deals out there. People are getting desperate. They want new, and they want new things. And Hollywood is waking up, and they are starting to sort of swing back into production. So you don't know what's going to happen. But all of you indie authors out there, you have to start promoting your book. And so I'm very thrilled that Phil Vega is out there this coming weekend in Tampa Bay for a very exciting film festival. And we do have some wonderful film festivals here in our area. Okay, so just again, remember, you know, what I always tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, a television series, like is what is going to happen with Jenny's book, and what would I hope will happen with Carol J. Perry's books, because she now has 11 books in her Witch City Mysteries, and I am really hoping and just trying to, you know, keep her name out there so that people in Hollywood will say, whoa, we need a new series on the Hallmark Channel, because I love the characters that Carol J. Perry has written. Really fun characters, and a wonderful one. My sister, Natalie, has, from the first book, she said, this should be on television. And so I'm hoping that somewhere out there in Hollywood, they will find Carol J. Perry. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. And he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. And boy, oh boy, I should have been a general, because I love getting saluted. I can just have a program where people have to come in. When they come in the door, they have to salute me. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Bye-bye now.